Nowhere in the pages of history can one find a greater champion of justice. Return with us now to those thrilling days of yesteryear.
And I'll tell you something else, too, is I cannot stand sissies.
You're going to talk about wrestling, that's redneck talk.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Dragon King Carl Classic Wrestling Audio Show here at WrestlingObserver.com, Figure4Online.com. I'm your host, Carl Stern. Thanks a lot for listening. Depending on when you hear this, it's either sometime in the future or it's Tuesday or Wednesday, January 19th or 20th, 2016. Not sure exactly when this show is going to go up and be posted, but we're here in middle of the month, January 2016. Today's show is going to be old school for us, question and answer show. I've got a couple good questions in the email bag. Probably going to go back to this format for a while. I've got to be honest, after changing the format of the show back a few months ago, kind of seeing how it was going to go, I'm seeing a notable kind of drop in interest, at least interaction with some of the shows and stuff. And so it seems like the question and answer format is kind of better. Now, we're going to continue to do biography shows along the way. That is one thing I am going to do, is intermix some biographies on down the road. The next one I'm going to do will probably be the next show. It will probably be on Jushin Liger. I've talked about this for two or three shows now. I'm actually going to do that probably the next show. But more of our shows than not are going to be mailbag shows. So if you want to go ahead and start sending in any topic suggestions or whatever to Carl at DragonKingCarl.com, that's Carl with the letter K, K-A-R-L at DragonKingCarl.com. I'll go ahead and start sorting those out. Now, I am going to do these different than in the past. In the past, I didn't, despite allegations otherwise, I never threw away an email. But I am going to be more selective about them. And if yours, again, this 2016, I've already talked about this, we're not having negativity this year. If your complaints with me or with the show or whatever, then don't waste your time sending it in. For those who do like it, you can listen. For those who don't like it, there are plenty of other audio on this website that you can listen to. So you're wasting your time complaining. I'm not even going to read it. You're not even making your point. Don't even care. If you want to talk about old school classic pro wrestling, then do that. If you want to talk about something we talked about on the show, add to it. Even correct it. That's fine. But if you're just here to gripe and complain because I didn't do something or didn't do your guy or didn't talk about this or should have done that, keep it to yourself. I'm not even reading it. You are wasting your time. Now, being that said, I will get at least six emails of people wasting their time. But that's fine. It takes me about 2 seconds to delete an email because I'm not even reading it. So I do have some good emails in the email bag for this episode, and we will get to those. Do want to start off by be remiss without mentioning, man, it's been a rough year so far for entertainment and wrestling and so forth. We've had yet another well-known wrestler pass away this week. Iron Mike Sharp passed away. In fact, I'll go ahead and get one of these emails that come in. It's from Travel. And Travel says, I really think we need a show on him. Everyone and anyone who watched 1980s WWF knows this guy and most likely loved his act and his jobber character. He is more well-known than I thought. His death was trending on news sites and even showed up in my Facebook news feed, if you can believe that. And my Facebook never, ever has mentioned anything connected with wrestling, so it wasn't something based on my Facebook. It was just there because it was news. Also, he was in need of a wheelchair in the last 10 years due to so much damage to his spine from wrestling. I know it's a sad thing, but I wouldn't mind a somber storytelling show about what this, quote, fake sport actually does to guys' bodies. Yeah, that's, I mean, there's no, unfortunately, no shortage of that from a variety of different perspectives, even if you take into the concussion thing that has become so topical in the last few years to all the shoulder injuries, guys from his time period, man, their backs are just, and knees are just destroyed. He says, he was my favorite guy as a teenager in the 1980s. I actually liked him more than most of the stars wrestling, if you can believe that. When I was playing wrestling with my younger stepbrother, I would often be Iron Mike Sharp, grunting and groaning and pretending to have a protector on my forearm. Of course, that meant I had to do something stupid like missing a clothesline and didn't doing the job to my brother. But that was the way it was for an Iron Mike fan. Yeah, that's great points, Travel. And as far as a show on him goes, I am working right now on putting one together of the whole Sharp family that's going to air at a later date. And so all this stuff about Iron Mike Sharp coming out now, I'm saving it and going to include it in that. That is something I'm actively working on right now. In fact, I've even got some basics done on that particular show. So keep in mind, sometime later this coming months, you're going to hear that. I don't want to say any more about that right now. But, yes, we're going to talk more about Iron Mike Sharp in the future. But certainly he's one of the most recognizable job guys out there. I mean, he got pushed in some other areas. He was pushed in Mid-South Wrestling, among other places. He was he's kind of interesting to me in that he's a guy that always seemed like he kind of needed to be pushed more than he was. He seemed to me like a guy that if I was running a territory, now at a certain point it becomes impossible because he did become so recognizable as a job guy there in WWF. So at a certain point in time, there really wasn't much else you could do with him because of that. But if you could have got to him before he became that job guy, based on the fact that his family were very famous, successful wrestlers in Japan, and he was a guy, he was a big guy. I've heard him described since his death as lacking charisma or something. I think that's wrong. I disagree with that totally. You wouldn't remember. I mean, look at the so many jobbers we had that you can't even remember their names, yet everybody remembers Mike Sharp. He did have a charisma. Now, it wasn't, you know, may not have been a world champion type charisma, but he was memorable. And I think if you were a guy with the right territory, you could have used the guy. He was big. He was competent. He did everybody remembers his vocalizations in the ring and stuff. He was very much that. With the right push, I think you could have took and done something with him. I think he would have been an excellent tag team wrestler paired with the right person, paired with somebody that was a little more classically charismatic and maybe more of a technician, and he would be the bigger brawler of the team. I think you could have done something with him before he got typecast in that jobber sort of role. But he was certainly, be that as it may, that's not what happened with his life. He ended up being really one of the more well-known faces of the enhancement guys there in WWF, and very memorable. And, I wouldn't call myself a fan of him, but he certainly, again, if he was somebody that I was running a promotion back then, I certainly would have used. But, yes, we would definitely be doing something on the career of Iron Mike Sharp and the entire Sharp family coming up. Sharp family is really one of those that's flown under my radar for so long. They were pioneers in Japan. They were their place in Japanese wrestling history, I think, has really been kind of underexplored here as far as the historians and stuff goes. And we need to bring them back to the forefront a little bit more. And again, it's tragic. Apparently, he had very serious health problems for quite some time, and that's really, really too bad. Want to make mention, I guess you could call it a plug if you want to, but I think it's going to be definitely of interest to people listening to this particular show. Want to mention a book coming back into publication. Now, I had a Xerox copy of this book years ago. I don't have it anymore. I don't even know what happened to it. Somebody actually made me a Xerox copy of it. It's been out of print for a long time, but it's really it's an excellent book to look back on this era of wrestling. And it's called Whatever Happened to Gorgeous George, The Blood and Ballyhoo of Professional Wrestling. And Scott Till sent me an email and told me that Crowbar Press, which you hear all the time, I brag on Crowbar Press books. They don't pay me nothing. I don't get free comps from them, nothing whatsoever. I just love their books. I think they're the best wrestling books that are out there. And Scott sent me an email saying that they are putting back into publication Whatever Happened to Gorgeous George. And this is the text that comes along with it. Says, there is a world where truth, beauty, and innocence battle nightly with the insidious subterranean forces of evil. Evil in the guise of the Beast, the Crusher, and the Missouri Mauler. Truth embodied in the French Angel, the Golden Superman, and Chief Big Heart is the world of pro wrestling. Whatever Happened to Gorgeous George is the story of the most outlandish personalities in the sport. Comic book figures with fanatical followings. Loving and hating them along the way are the maniacal fans who follow them to the arenas, screaming and roving theaters of the absurd. This is awkwardly worded. Piccolo Pete, Hatpin Mary, and the septuagenarian sisters from Baltimore, to name a few. Then come backstage with the boys and see what the brutal world of wrestling is all about. Cauliflower ears, fan-inflicted knife and gun wounds, matches fought in the mud, ice cream, bloody grudge brawls, wacky practical jokes. You might even learn a few holds, like the atomic drop or the stomach claw, or pick up some nifty villainous stunts. It is illustrated with spectacular photos of the wrestlers. Whatever Happened to Gorgeous George is the definitive inside story of pro wrestling, complete with a chronology of the sport and biographies of the greatest wrestlers. It is also a collection of some of the wildest stories ever told and a funny, irreverent look at the most colorful theatrical sport on the American scene. Now, you may think from that awkwardly worded press release that this is going to be a book making fun of wrestling, and it is kind of that vein, which you as a wrestling fan, I'm sure, have grown accustomed to that. But if you could dive past the surface, this book's very interesting. It broke kayfabe way back when. I think this book is in like late 60s, early 70s, something like that. I mean, it's using real names. It's outing masked wrestlers. It's got all kinds of stuff like that. It is very interesting. I mean, I'm sure this book was highly controversial at the time it came out, because it was very, very, I mean, it outed people by name and everything else. It was just they totally broke kayfabe here. Now, a lot of it is to old school wrestlers telling outlandish stories that may or may not have any truth to them, but at the same time, there's a lot of it's kind of like the sort of a comedic Observer newsletter from back in this day. Just for example, I mean, again, you got to go back to, and I wish I could remember what exactly the year was this book was. Oh, it was first published in 1974. So, again, keep that in mind. It's 1974 when kayfabe is in full effect. Just listen to this excerpt. This is an excerpt from Chapter 4. I'm getting this from the crowbarpress.com website, where you can go to order the book, crowbarpress.com. Excerpt for Chapter 4. This is a quote from Mildred Burke. So this is Mildred Burke speaking. I have Moolah's girls try to come to me because Moolah treats them like dogs and they're prisoners. I had one of the girls of mine that run off and went with Moolah. I don't think Moolah lured her off. She's wrestling as White Venus in all different names. She's changed about 10 different times. Well, I took that girl. She was 18 when I took her, and had her sign a contract, but at that time, you weren't of age until you turned 21. Now they've got a new law. I made her a lot of money. I sent her to Japan, sent her to Canada twice. She was making about $500 a week. When she came to me, she was a horrible-looking person. She was 5 feet 8 inches and weighed about 255 pounds, and had her hair cut off short like a man's. She wasn't a lesbian, but she had all the appearances because she was built funny and had a big old body. But I saw her in very pretty saw she had very pretty features. So we trimmed her down, let her hair grow out, bleached it blonde, and she made a very, very good girl. So, my God, you can see what this book is going to be quite interesting here. I mean, you got straight up Mildred Burke being socially incorrect, dogging the crap out of Fabulous Moolah, who was opposite promoting from her. And, I mean, just reading some of these excerpts down through here from the different chapters or something else. And then, if I remember correctly, my copy had a like an appendix in the back of wrestlers with their real names, including masked wrestlers, who they were, and everything else. And it was something else. So definitely, if you're interested in that, definitely check it out. Again, that's from Scott Teal over at crowbarpress.com. And again, a lot of those Crowbar Press books I'm huge, huge fans of. And by the way, this is like the third radio show I've taped today, so I apologize if I'm losing my voice, because I am, and I'm stumbling over my words, because I am. And remind me never to try to do that many shows at one time again. I was just trying to get some stuff taped ahead. I want to also mention the Memphis Filsinger Games, or the Filsinger Games. They're working on a Memphis subset to go with that. Been really impressed with those games here lately. Now, I don't play them. I'm familiar with them. If you remember, if you're from my age set, and we talked about back in the days of the magazines and stuff, they used to always take out ads in like Pro Wrestling Illustrated and all the after mags and stuff. Well, now they've transitioned into finally licensing out actual real world wrestlers. They've got like now, obviously, they don't do WWE, but there's a lot of independent groups that they're doing and classic old school wrestling stuff. And, man, the art on some of these cards and stuff is really tremendous. I've been following them on Twitter for a little while. And from time to time, they'll pop up some artwork and stuff from their cards. And just very impressed with that. I can see how that would be I dabbled with those games back years ago. And really, they look like they've improved so much. So they've kind of piqued my interest on that. And I was contacted by a gentleman named Travis, who is working on a Memphis set, a classic Memphis set. I'm talking about from like the 1970s. And so I got to preview some of that artwork and stuff from there and some of the cards. And it is out of this world fantastic. If you've ever gave a second thought to any of the Filsinger games, those card games and stuff, Champions of the Galaxy back, I remember those ads were all over the After magazines and stuff. If you ever thought about those, check them out on Twitter. Check out, I'm sure they've got a website, so we don't have it right at my disposal. I'm sure you can Google up Filsinger games and get that. But the spelling of that is Filsinger, Filsinger, Filsinger. Well worth looking at. Just for been really impressed with that artwork and stuff. Here's a follow-up from something we talked about several shows back about who's had the most wrestling matches. And I was hoping this would spark a lot of conversation and stuff. And I've got several emails, but nothing really seems that definitive. We still haven't nailed down, maybe we never will, who has had the most matches and who's had the most ring time. I still think we're settling in, it seems like, on somebody in Mexico. And Negro Casas' name has come up a lot. Gypsy Joe here in the U.S., and he did some work down in Mexico also, his name's come up a lot, mainly because he wrestled till he was so old, up in his 70s. You got to think Mil Máscaras is there somewhere. Mil Máscaras has still, I mean, I think he's even wrestling. He's in his 70s now, and he still wrestles occasionally. He doesn't do nearly as much as he used to, but he's, gosh, you got to think, what about Abdullah the Butcher, man? He wrestled up into his 70s also, and he did a lot of indie work where later on, after he was too old and hurt to do the big shows and stuff. He still did a lot of indie shows and stuff. Even he couldn't even get in the ring at certain points in time. He would just brawl out on the floor and get counted out, and still would have to count as a match. But Rob from Saskatoon says this. Saskatoon, let's see, wasn't there a great Guess Who song about Saskatoon, running back to Saskatoon? Is that what it was? Oh, gosh, man, talk about music. I'll get to your email right here in a second, Rob. But, my gosh, it was at the time I'm recording this, yesterday we lost Glenn Frey of the Eagles. Right on the heels of David Bowie. And the drummer from Mott the Hoople died. Of course, that's not as big a star, I guess, as those two guys. But Glenn Frey, obviously, I grew up with David Bowie music and stuff, and he was a highly revered person. But more to me, I was certainly more of an Eagles fan than I was a David Bowie fan. Although my Eagles, I gravitated more toward Don Henley than Glenn Frey. But gosh, it's the end of the Eagles. It's got to be. I mean, they were not talking about doing anything new as of last year. They had pretty much completed a tour. There had been magazines articles saying that they were not planning anything new, any new tours, any new music. So it might have been the end of the Eagles anyway, but certainly is now, and that's too bad. If you've not saw the Eagles documentary, I think it's still on Netflix. If it's not, it's for certain on iTunes. It's a must watch, even if you don't even care about the Eagles. It's a must watch. Now, Glenn Frey has never come across as the nicest guy. That's just the fact. And in this documentary, he continues to come across as not the nicest guy. Him and another member of the band, Don Felder, were archenemies. And he doesn't come off good at all in the documentary. But still, what a loss for the music world. It's really something else, but. I hate to get sidetracked on that, but it needed to be said. 2016, so wrestling and music, lost several people already. Was Lemmy in Lemmy Kilmister, Motorhead, was he in 2016 or was he right at the end of last year? Anyway, last couple months has been something else. Now to get back from Rob from Saskatoon, sorry about that. That tangent on Saskatoon, getting a Guess Who song. But he said, here's a resource that is the most complete one I can find online about the numbers of matches by wrestlers. Now, obviously, there will never be a 100% accurate wrestling result database, but this one is excellent for Japan and the USA. It is, however, lacking older Mexican results. The 9,000 number that was mentioned by the guy who initially emailed you seemed really high to me, and that was Jason Campbell, one of the best wrestling researchers out there, a collector of match results himself, said this database, and again, he's referring to wrestlingdata.com, and I am familiar with it, and that is one of the things that was in the conversation. It is excellent, very, very good. It is incomplete substantially, and it doesn't claim to be. There are a lot of missing matches for a lot of people, but they do have a lot. I mean, this is good, about as good a database as you're going to get. But Rob says, this data has Ric Flair listed at 5,218. It is probably missing some of Flair's early matches, but it is pretty accurate, and I could see Flair's actual number being much higher than around 6,000. And while I could certainly see some Mexican guys being around that number, I can't fathom anyone being close to 9,000 matches in their career. So anyway, the database is at wrestlingdata.com. I follow Jason's logic in coming up with that 9,000 match number. I mean, that really is probably the cap. It really is. I've even heard the 10,000 match number floated. I think Dave Meltzer even floated that out possibly for like Negro Casas. That to me seems way much. I do think Ric Flair probably 6,000 seems fairly good for Ric Flair. You have to remember Flair's not wrestled in a while now. While quite a few people his age have continued on. in the Indies, Jerry Lawler being another one. Again, I champion Jerry Lawler as being in the contention for this. Now, I don't know that he's going to be up there with Negro Casas and even Atlantis and people like that. I still think it's going to wind up being somebody in Mexico, because Mexico did so many shows, so many days a week, sometimes multiple days a week, that you never heard about, never hit the radar. Those guys worked from the time they were very, very young, younger than 18, all the way till they were well older than they should have stopped working. So just by sheer age, they have the ability to have had more matches. So I still think it's going to be there. Japan, certain promotions there had off seasons. They didn't run as frequently for as long as places in Mexico. And so if it's going to be somebody in the U.S., it's going to be somebody that had a substantial run in multiple territories in the 70s and 80s, and then maybe had a run with WWF and or WCW there in the 90s, but then did a lot of work in the Indies. Whoever, if it's going to be somebody in the U.S., it's going to, I think, have to be somebody that had a very substantial post-Monday Night Wars indie run. That, again, takes in Jerry Lawler. It takes in Bill Dundee. Takes in Abdullah the Butcher. Let's see, who else? Tommy Rich. Although I don't think Tommy Rich is going to be in contention there, since for a number of reasons. I think he came along too late to do that really hard schedule. He had time periods where he didn't wrestle that much, so I don't think he's there. But it's going to be a guy like that. I say Bob Armstrong's a possibility too, considering his work in the 60s and 70s. Now, he did slow down working a lot in the 80s, but honest to God, Bob Armstrong worked continuously in the 1990s. I mean, he worked. I tried. In the 1990s, it was almost impossible to book a date with Bob Armstrong because he was booked up. If you had a Friday, Saturday, or Sunday card, you weren't getting Bob unless you booked him well ahead in advance. And, I mean, the same goes for Scott. Now, Steve got hurt early on, and so he's, you know, he wasn't in that mix. But I would say Bullet Bob Armstrong's got to be fairly well up there. I mean, he's got to be in the running maybe. But I think he's going to be behind Jerry Lawler. Look at how regular that Memphis ran. And Southeastern and Continental did too. But when Continental started trailing off, they started doing a lot less shows. So, you know, I wonder about that. I feel like there's somebody obviously that we're overlooking. Jimmy Valiant's had a lot of matches. I mean, Jimmy Valiant was another one of those guys that works all the time still this day on the independent scene. Although I don't think he was one of the harder travelers back in the 80s. But again, yeah, maybe he was. You look at what he did in Memphis, and you look what he did in Mid-Atlantic, and so maybe he was. Maybe he's in the running too. But to me, I really feel like we're going to settle in on somebody from Mexico. So hopefully we can come to a better consensus. And again, I invite more speculation emails. And if you got a case to be made, please do so and send it in to Carl at DragonKingCarl.com. All right, we're going to take our first break coming up here. And when we come back, we're going to look at our main topic for this show. That is going to be a history of kayfabe. Yeah, history of kayfabe. What's that all about? So we'll talk about that after the break right here. And again, the email address for the show is carl@dragonkingcarl.com. It's Carl, letter K, K-A-R-L @dragonkingcarl.com. I am Dragon King Carl on Twitter. And I have a Facebook now. Yes, I have a Facebook page for the radio shows. It is Dragon King Radio. That's two words, Dragon King and Radio. Please go like the page. I'd like to see get a good amount of followers there. Now, right now it's more oriented toward the Dragon King Dark stuff, but I am starting to include wrestling stuff as well. And as we get more wrestling fans following, please check into it. Please feel free to interact with the page. I would love to have a lot of people stopping by there, because that's real handy to post video and photos and stuff I talk about here on the show, where if I talk about a match or something you need to go out of your way to see, it's easy to post it on there and stuff. So it's just really kind of helpful to diversify that. Plus, of course, it's another good avenue to hopefully send out information about the Super Stern Stick flash drive available at DragonKingCarl.com. So definitely check that out too. All right, we'll be right back after this break.
To my left, the 200... Excuse me just a minute, but I thought I'd help you commentate this match. Being Southeastern champion, I want to watch the Flame Defenders Alabama title right here.
If you plan to commentate this match, Armstrong, you can do it by yourself.
Ladies and gentlemen, this match, one fall, a 15-minute time limit, Alabama state title on the line. To my left, 225, Milton, Florida's Greg Cooley. His opponent, 292, parts unknown, the state of Alabama heavyweight champion, The Flame.
Well, I'll just watch The Flame. If The Plant saw fit to leave me, I'll just show him that I can do a better job than him. At least the people can understand me. I don't sound like Country Charlie Platt out here going to talk about wrestling. That's redneck talk. Maybe you folks can understand wrestling a little bit. Right away, I'd like to say that I think The Flame's got a lot of guts for putting his title up right here on TV. And I see Rick Stewart.
This is an unusual circumstance.
Yeah, it's very unusual. I've excused Charlie Platt, and you can go too. If he wants me to commentate by myself, I can handle it. Rick Stewart, go find the TV and listen and find out how to commentate a match. A beautiful move by The Flame there, and a headlock took the man right over. What guts this Flame has got, putting his title up right on TV. Just like Fanny told me the other day, she said, Bullet Baby Whit Bob has a new vocation now. I will comment this match. Now here goes Mr. Cooley. He's trying a foolish effort here, trying to outpower a man like The Flame. Need I say more? A picture is worth a thousand words. A beautiful move by The Flame. You know, The Flame's a lot like the Bullet. He moves with the grace and speed of a gazelle. He weighs close to 300 pounds and moves like a lightweight. We trained together, and I know what this, which is perfectly legal, and here he throws the man in. Let's see what he does. Look, there's that vicious double chop. It looks like another 1-2-3. Another win for the Alabama champion, and man, what a man with intestinal fortitude, and for you rednecks, that means you got... Let me see if I can get him over here a minute. Come over here a minute, Flame. Come over here, son. That was a great match, a real great match. I'll tell you, that Flame is a champion, true deserving of the fans' admiration, and brother... Let me congratulate you on a fantastic match.
Thank you. Thank you.
One thing about it, I'll ask The Flame. A lot of people have asked about Miss Fannie Mae Titwaller, and I did introduce The Flame to Miss Fannie Mae Titwaller. What did you think about Miss Fannie Mae, Flame?
One of the most gorgeous women that I've ever met.
Okay, everybody, we're back. And going to take the second half of the show here to address this email. It's from Brandon. And Brandon has a question we've talked about here on the show before, but it's quite a good question. It's one that really bears talking about again, and it has everything to do with the history of wrestling. It's one of the most fascinating things about wrestling. And the question Brandon writes in, or actually the what he writes in to say is, are there any audio shows or newsletters of yours that would be particularly good for learning about how, when, and why pro wrestling matches started becoming worse and the history of kayfabe? And the answer to that is yes. I would say that the most, start off with the written word, the most important thing I think I ever wrote on the subject would have been the Pioneers of Wrestling special, which is a PDF that's available on the Super Stern Stick. Now, I can make a copy of that available to you also by probably email for download for sure. I think I used to have it up on my website for 99 cents. I even think at one point in time it was archived here on the Observer site. So I don't want to charge you for it if you, you know, if you find it out there somewhere else. But I can't also spend all day sending out free copies of the Pioneers of Wrestling special. But if you're interested in it, it is on the Super Stern Stick flash drive which is available at DragonKingCarl.com. That and much, much more that would help you in the pursuit of the answer to this question. Now, to give a basic answer to this question, the most easily understandable answer to this question, I will say wrestling has always been worked. Now, that is not a blanket 100% statement, but here's how it happened. We're just confining this conversation to North America, United States, because wrestling goes back as far as man has existed. I mean, there are carvings in ancient Egypt depicting wrestling. Wrestling is discussed in the book of Genesis in the Bible. As long as mankind's been around, we've been racing each other on foot and wrestling and fighting. And so, you know, to ask when did wrestling start becoming worked, well, that's an impossible question to answer. So we're going to have to bring our perimeters in a little bit. We're talking about professional wrestling, and to find out when that is, we've got to narrow our perimeters down to professional wrestling in the United States, which is where professional wrestling as we know it got its start. Now, we started professional wrestling began being made up of different ingredients. It wasn't a thing that just flourished into life. What happened was, is people immigrated into the United States. They brought with them their ritual forms of wrestling. If they were from parts of England and Scotland, then they had specialized rules of wrestling there that they brought with them. If they were from parts of Europe, Germany, into even the Asian countries, even Africa, there were different people were wrestling. They were just doing it differently. And when they got here to the United States, it really, not just figuratively, but literally became a merging, a melding of all these different styles. And so what began as professional wrestling here was actually subdivided up into a number of different styles. And some of the more famous ones, as you've heard me talk about before, were things like collar and elbow and Cumberland style and doofer style and catch-as-catch-can style and Greco-Roman style, of course. And there were a variety of different types of wrestling with different rules involved. As these things started beginning to blend together, and they really congealed around the Civil War, because troops in the Civil War weren't just fighting all day. They were on long marches to where battles were going to take place. They were in camps. They were together for long periods of time. And to pass the time, you've got these usually young men with a lot of, to use old, out-of-date words, a lot of vim and vigor. And so they would naturally be competitive with one another. Ball games like baseball and football, those hadn't even really been invented yet, basketball. And so they wrestled, and they raced, and they did boxed and did things like that. And so you would have these people from different backgrounds. Either them or their forefathers, their parents or their grandparents, would have been from another country besides America, usually. And they would say, let me show you how to do this type of wrestling. And then the other person would say, well, okay, this is the type of wrestling I know. And then sometimes they would mix those around. They would say, hey, we'll have one fall in your type of wrestling, one fall in another type of wrestling, and a third fall in another type of wrestling, and whoever wins the most falls wins the match. So that become the original mixed style of wrestling. So when you go back and look at old newspaper accounts and stuff, when they talk about mixed matches, they aren't talking about like today where it's a man and a woman involved in the same match. These were actually mixed styles of matching, of wrestling. And so they became intertwined and kind of meshed together, and there came to be a kind of a generalized kind of more free form of wrestling called catch as catch can. You've probably heard pro wrestling, especially back in the territorial era, Gordon Soley, people like that would refer to pro wrestling as catch as catch can wrestling. Well, that's not really what it looked like back then, but that was a generalized term meaning, hey, we're going to kind of mash all these rules together and have a match here. And some of the matches required pinfalls. Some of them required just throwing your opponent off balance where 3 points would touch the ground, a hand, a foot, and a knee. You know, that would constitute a fall. Or perhaps this style meant you had to put an opponent down on the ground on their back. And there were a variety. There were certain styles that meant you could have no holds below the waist, meaning you just worked from the waist up to throw your opponent off balance. And so different wrestling matches had different rules. And so as this become really congealed into a art form there around the Civil War, we famously talked about Abraham Lincoln legitimately was a wrestler. We've got newspaper accounts of some of the matches he had. If you go back and look at that Pioneers of Wrestling special, plus some issues I did of the old Dragon King newsletter that are also on the Super Stern Stick, you'll read about Abraham Lincoln before he became president, before he grew up being part of a wrestling troupe. And so all this was coming together around the time of the Civil War. So when you get out of the Civil War, the post-Civil War era, you have kind of your first real stars of wrestling coming out. Guys who decided, hey, I've got this skill, I'm going to make some money with it. You have guys like Colonel James H. McLaughlin, who was a colonel for the Union in the Civil War. You had guys like William Muldoon, who come up a little later, and Jim McMahon, and quite a few others who, even former slaves, Vero Small, a former slave, was a wrestler. And so they figured out that a way to make money with this, which was by gambling. And so there you have the first ingredient you really need to make kayfabe, make worked matches. Because now that we got money involved, I can work with you, my opponent, and we can get them to bet on the favorite and have an upset, and you and I can split the profits. And so that's how wrestling kind of become worked, was it was a gambling scheme. And at that time, we're talking again about the late 1800s at this point. What else was becoming big in America? Well, it was the carnivals, the traveling circuses, P.T. Barnum and his circus. You had every town and state had their yearly or quarterly carnival and circus. And, you know, what a great thing to have there was these at shows, the wrestling. And what a great way to learn how to fleece the marks, which was carnival terminology. That's how you get into this whole kayfabe language, kayfabe, marks, all that stuff, baby faces, heels, all these wrestling insider terms were adopted from the carnivals because they started traveling with the carnivals. They literally ran off and joined the circus. And they would go around town to town, place to place, employing this scam to make money. I mean, this is how prevalent it was. I mean, the newspapers were on to this con game by the 1870s. Now, I start seeing really the mentioning that wrestling's not on the level to the degree that not just isolated newspapers, but it seemed like the whole sports journal community is in on the gag. Again, that's by the 1870s. So you're not too long out of the Civil War at that point. One of the first guys who does really what we would consider, I guess, the genesis of promoting on a regular basis was William Muldoon. And Muldoon added a lot of aspects that would further work go into working matches. He added things like time limits, and he added a more unified type style. But you still had these guys going around what was called barnstorming. I mean, you'd have guys traveling the country. They would go sometimes in in sometimes with circuses, sometimes with carnivals, sometimes just as their own thing. They would go town to town, territory to territory, area to area, and basically work that place over in a con. So that's how you really get the origins of what was kayfabe. Again, that's a carnival term that was used to, I mean, again, it's, gosh, as long as wrestling's been around, it seems like it's been worked. The whole athletic endeavor of it lost its appeal to audiences pretty early on. Now, did that mean the whole thing was shady? Did it mean the whole thing was crooked? No, there were legitimate matches up until probably the 1930s. There were a number of legitimate matches. It has often been debated amongst wrestling historians about, you know, some of the most famous matches in wrestling history. Were they works? Were they shoots? You can use different things to evidence what you think. I would say some of those very lengthy Ed Strangler Lewis versus Joe Stecker matches from back in the 1920s and 30s probably were shoots. I mean, because they were lasting, you know, 4 or 5 hours long. William Muldoon is reported to have had a 9-hour long match with Clarence Whistler. Probably that's not a work. But did Clarence Whistler and William Muldoon work matches? I think they did. I think there's some evidence that absolutely they went from town to town once they got their, quote, act together and did that. Frank Gotch, were a lot of his matches shoots? I think there were some of his matches that were shoots, sure. I also think he did his fair share of working. I mean, he was barnstorming along with his trainer and mentor, Farmer Burns, and they even traveled up to the Yukon at the very end of Colonel James McLaughlin's career. They were up there in the Yukon barnstorming together, and I have no doubt Ole Olson and was another guy that was up there on that. I have no doubt that they were working every bit of that. Probably that was a scam to take gold people up there in the Yukon on gold mining missions. Taking their money away from them. Lumberjacks, logging camps and stuff, they were doing the same. Wherever they could find a dime to be made, they were going doing that. So I have really very little doubt that a lot of those matches were worked. I think back to the famous world title change between Frank Gotch and Fred Beale, and that one has me kind of baffled because that match had a high spot in it with the orchestra pit dive. That match was the enormous underdog won, but Gotch won the belt back very soon thereafter. That one to me is either explainable one of two ways. It was either a shoot that Gotch just got caught in, or there was a lot of betting against Fred Beale because he was such an underdog, and they decided to mop up the money together, split it, and Gotch would get his championship back just a short time later. A lot of people point toward the 1920 Joe Stecker and Earl Caddick match as one of the last great shoot world title matches, and I think that's probably true. I look at that match, and now some people have argued, there's some wrestling critics and historian who have said, no, that match too was worked. At least the finish of it was. I none of us know. Make no mistake about it. All we have to go by is our evidences of it. They see some evidence that the match was worked. I don't. It looks like a shoot to me. But again, maybe they're right. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it's the truth somewhere in between. Now, if your question is, when did it become a work all the time? I feel like it became a work. And again, you can't say all the time because you can still have shoot matches this day. There's still occasionally going to be a double cross. There's still going to be something. What do you say about the Shawn Michaels, Bret Hart, Montreal Screwjob? That match wasn't a shoot, but it was a double cross, so there was a shoot aspect to it. How do you categorize that? And that stuff happened all the time back in the 20s and 30s. I would say wrestling became primarily a work, meaning, hey, we know what we're doing here. It ain't on the up and up. Here's your role. Here's my role. We're going to do it. But occasionally there were still shoots involved. I would say that really came into being in the 1930s. And I think really you primarily blame Strangler Lewis for it. He was a legit shooter, one of the toughest guys ever to be in the wrestling business, no doubt. He could handle himself against double crosses and whatever, but I think he was also the first real true businessman who knew that and knew that there was money in giving this championship to this person for a little while. I can take it back when I want it, if it comes to that, or we can all work together and make money. And there were some shoots, certainly, in Strangler Lewis's career, but I think predominantly that's when working became widespread and commonplace. By the time you get into the 1940s, and certainly by the 1950s, it was an entertainment business. And there was no even pretense inside the business itself, if you were on the inside, what this was. Lou Thesz was reputed to be this great shooter and all that, but even Thesz himself, in his biography and later interviews and stuff, I mean, even he would concede that he wasn't a shooter like Strangler Lewis or Frank Gotch, or that what he was doing was different. And so by the 40s and 50s, the 50s for sure, any vestiges left of wrestling being an actual legit sport were out. So I would say the transition period is really the 1930s, if you just want to put a decade on it. But before that, even, I mean, you had clearly everything wasn't on the up and up. And by design, it wasn't, because it was a money-making deal. So, Brandon, I certainly hope that that answered your question to the greatest degree I could do so. Before we go, we'll hit one more email, because I don't know the answer to this question, even though this is kind of in my wheelhouse and such. If somebody out there knows more about this, please do so. Please write in. This is from Sean. And Sean says, on a recent Observer's This Day in Wrestling History, I saw that Bill Dundee won a scaffold battle royal. I can imagine what this match was in theory, but if you know about it, could you explain the match to me in a little more detail? First off, the match seems extremely dangerous, like most scaffold matches are, but I was wondering how many people did they have on the scaffold at once? Also, what was the impetus for this match? I imagine that ultimately the match was unsuccessful or didn't draw well, as this was the first time I ever heard of one. I have no idea. I've never heard of that. I saw that listed too. No idea what that was. The scaffold matches did start in Memphis, or started in Tennessee. So it doesn't really surprise me that they tried to do other gimmick stuff with it. That was right up the Memphis territory, right up Jerry Jarrett's alley to do stuff like this. But I have no idea how that would even work without somebody dying, and no idea what that was. Sean goes on to say, I've heard in the past that Bill Dundee was the innovator of the scaffold match, with one of the first participants being Coco Beware. That's not true. That is the story that's been out there. That is the popular story. It was actually Jerry Jarrett early on, and one of the, who was it? It was one of the brothers, Don or Al Green one, had the first scaffold match that I know of. So I think it was a Jerry Jarrett and Al Green or Don Green idea. They were in the first one that I knew of that well predated the Bill Dundee Coco Ware one. Now, they did have an early scaffold match, but it was far from the first. So I'd love to hear more about this wacky scaffold match battle royal, and possibly, which I think would make for a good show, the history of the scaffold match. And yeah, that's something I wish you'd look at. Man, the scaffold match to me was always one of the most ridiculously dangerous matches. I don't know how somebody didn't end up killed in those Rock and Roll Express, Midnight Express, or Road Warriors and Midnight Express scaffold matches. Those were so dangerous. And the scaffold was so high. And then when you get into some of the garbage match stuff that was done later on, it's a thousand wonders somebody didn't end up dead in one of those. Sean goes on to say, also, I've been wanting to email you a question about a half-formed memory I have when I was a kid relating to the Georgia Territory. It comes across as a half-formed memory because I've never heard it mentioned either here or on this day in history articles or anywhere else for that matter. What I remember as a match was part of a supercard on Thanksgiving, probably pre-Starcade, and it was basically something of a cage match battle royal taking place, possibly at the end of a card. The participants would be in the cage, possibly with the first person climbing out of the cage receiving a prize, and the last person remaining in the cage would win the Turkey of the Year award. Memory serves me correct, one of the turkeys of the year was Iron Sheik, the other being Brutus Beefcake. I'm less sure about the latter winner being Brutus Beefcake, as I don't know if he ever wrestled the Georgia Territory, but I'm sure, pretty sure Iron Sheik was a recipient of the Turkey of the Year. Yeah, I think that actually happened. That seems right. I do know that Iron Sheik won something like that. Now, it wouldn't have been Brutus Beefcake. It would have been Ed Leslie, who definitely wrestled in Georgia as Ed Leslie. So, it's very possible you're not misremembering that, too, although I don't know about that. But I do know Iron Sheik did do something similar to what you're talking about. And that sounds right. I don't know that I've ever seen the match, but that the rules you explained do sound kind of right there. All right. I guess that's going to wrap it up for this edition of the show. Again, if you want to start sending your emails in again, topic suggestions, follow-ups, whatever, send those to carl@dragonkingcarl.com. It's Carl, letter K, K-A-R-L at Dragon King Carl. Now, I'm also Dragon King Carl on Twitter. Please follow me there. I'm trying to build my Twitter following. I tweet a lot of stuff about old school wrestling. In fact, there's a lot of great stuff that I don't just put out there firsthand, but retweet other great historians. There's a great Twitter account by Seth Hansen out there that does a lot of great Twitter stuff as well. But follow me, DragonKingCarl.com. You get a lot of that. Also, I have a Facebook page now. Please like that page if you would. If you're on Facebook, it is Dragon King Radio, two words, Dragon King Radio. Check that out. And again, ultimately, I hope you will at some point in time make your way to DragonKingCarl.com, my website, DragonKingCarl.com. And if you haven't ordered a Super Stern Stick, please do. It's 16-gigabyte flash drive, $20, free shipping worldwide. I am now including all the biographies on there on new purchases. If you have a Super Stern Stick before the biographies were added, you can download those at my website as well. It's a $5 download for all the biographies we've done. It's a digital download, so you don't have to wait on anything. All available through PayPal. But again, if you want the Super Stern Stick flash drive, over 400 podcasts, I guess I've got to do a recount now that I've added the biographies, because it's probably going to be approaching 500 now podcasts on there dealing with classic wrestling history and a lot more. There's over 500 PDFs on there dealing with wrestling history, including the entire run of the Dragon King Press newsletter, that Pioneers of Wrestling special I talked about, PDFs dealing with martial arts and a lot more stuff, fitness, all kinds of stuff on there. If you like to read, there's no shortage of stuff on there. Honestly, it would take you forever to go through all the material that's on there. Match results, just tons of stuff. Do check that out again. That is DragonKingCarl.com. Thanks for listening. My voice is just about gone now, so we'll call it a day here. Thanks a lot. We'll be back soon with another show. And also, after Dragon King Dark, don't forget about Dragon King Dark on AfterDarkRadioShow.com. Thanks a lot for listening.
The Boogie Woogie Man vibe. A lot of threats, a lot of words from Tully Blanchard Enterprises has been directed towards this man. Towards this man.
Today I have never been dropped from my wig. Ha-ha-da than I have by Danger Dillon on the concrete floor, baby. What's this, the boogeyman, baby? Wide open, open, wide open. All my people, my brothers and sisters. All my people, my brothers and sisters. In the streets, in the alleys, in the joints, wherever you are. All my people, my brothers and sisters. You know Boogeyman's with ya. You know Boogeyman's with ya. Fox blood, Dusty Rhodes. Fox blood, Dusty Rhodes. The American dream. The American dream.
You know Boogie Man's with ya. You know Boogie Man's with ya. We're tight, Jack. Everybody knows. We're tight, Jack. Everybody knows. I don't have to prove it. The Dustmen don't have to prove it. They thought by getting to the Boogie Man. Boogie Man. They're about to get to the Dustman. Boogie Woogie Man. Boogie Woogie Man. Yeah! Yeah!
Jimmy, a Boogie Woogie Man vibe.